Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Shane Lowry rolling in a birdie putt on 18 to knock off Russell Henley and to retain the cup. They ended up getting another full point and beating the Americans over the weekend at Bethpage Black 15-13. But man, it was a rout over the first 2 days before the drama of day three. I know it coincides with football season, and that makes it rough for a lot of you that like this event. I watched a lot of it over the weekend. Steve Sands was, of course, a part of the coverage. He joins us right now. Steve would rather talk about the Atlanta loss on Sunday, but I haven't talked about Ryder Cup, and I just want to start with this simple question. Why are they better than us at this event?
That's a great question. First of all, two things, Kevin. The iPad may or may not have had the Sunday ticket on and watching the Falcons and Skins game while we were in the booth on Sunday.
Yeah, I know. You do that all
just
the time.
Just don't tell the boss.
Yeah.
I think the boss kind of knows, though.
Did you let out
monitors those monitors in the trucks, they definitely have football on somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. You've told me this before, that you guys that are on the PGA Tour, especially in these fall events, these big events when football's going on, you're basically, or like during the NCAA, during March Madness, you're watching, a lot of those games. I mean, have you ever, like in the midst of calling something, just blurted out, "Oh my God, Chris Rodriguez, just keep going, go!"
No. Thank goodness.
You're a pro.
No, it's kind of like cursing. Hopefully, it never happens. Even though it happens all the time. No, that has not happened. But the other thing I was going to tell you was, we do have a little sidebar of whatever NCAA turned during the Valspar Championship. I can't tell you how many times I've said Justin Thomas for birdie at 12. And then look to my left and see a last-second shot and not being able to react is very strange. But anyway, the other thing I was going to tell you was, to solve all those issues, you got to be married to Val Sands. Val Sands allows us to have three televisions in our family room set up nicely. Doesn't look like a sports bar. Very classy. But it kind of solves the issue of in-game, red zone,
like,
and Ryder Cup.
It's very classy. I love that. Yeah, there was a time in my marriage very early on where you'll appreciate this. Maryland basketball was on probation. Okay, these are the, post-Bob Wade years, the early Gary Williams years. Yep. And in 1994, when they got really good again, she was like, "I didn't know that you were a Maryland basketball fan." I'm like, "It's actually my number one, sweetheart, and get used to it. These March runs are all enveloping, and we'll have multiple TVs on, but it'll look classy." All right, continue.
The reason that they are better, it's a great question, kind of unanswered, really. I mean, here's what I think. They're just better at the whole thing. They're not better players, Kevin, but they're just better at the entire operation. They have a system with their captains and vice captains. They do things correctly each and every time. Now, they don't win every time. American players 1 through 12 are better pretty much every year. They should be better, should be favored pretty much every year. But the Ryder Cup has gone to Europe 6 of the last 8 times it's been played. It's just crazy. And I think it's part preparation, Kevin. I think it's part picking the right captain, having the right vibe. Very difficult for Keegan Bradley as a contemporary at 39 years of age who plays with these guys all year to make very difficult decisions that captains and coaches have to make as far as pairings, as far as sitting someone, delivering news that not necessarily is very comfortable. Luke Donald is a young guy, but he's a half generation ahead of the guys who played on the team. You know, he's in his mid-40s. So does that make any sense to you? I think it's very difficult for Keegan Bradley to say to Colin Morikawa and Harris English, you guys just lost 5-4 yesterday. We're not playing you today. But he put them out there again, and they got waxed again on Saturday, because it's got to be an awfully big challenge for Keegan Bradley, Kevin, to look at Colin Morikawa and Harris English, whom he might be playing with this week at the Sanderson Farms Championship, or last week or 2 weeks ago at the Tour Championship or in Napa, and have to make very difficult calls. So I just think all around Europe is better at it.
Yeah, so I want to go back to Sunday. Sunday started with an injury to Victor Hovland. He woke up with a neck injury, couldn't play, and they have this thing called, you know, the envelope rule, where basically each team, rather than seeding the point, you know, based on an injury and defaulting that singles match, this is a long-standing rule, part of Ryder Cup. Each team gets a half point. But explain how the whole thing works in terms of the player on the U.S. roster that gets left out.
Yeah, it's been a long-standing rule. The rule needs to be changed, first and foremost. But the Ryder Cup is a lot different than it was back in 1927 and back in 1971 and all these other years. It's just completely different events. So the way it works is each team, just in case there is a scenario where a player can't go for whatever reason, family or health, they have to put a name in an envelope, and it's sealed. And if a player can't go, then the person who is matched up with him on the other team, in this case, Harris English for the United States, was going to go in the 12th match with Victor Hovland. When Victor couldn't go, they unseal the envelope. It says Harris English, and Harris English can't play, and each team gets a half point. Here's the reason why that rule has to change. And it has to change, Kevin. You cannot be in professional sports. You can't be in Little League, in my opinion, but in professional sports at the highest level. If you can't go, if you can't compete, if you're not available, you can't earn anything. That's just not how sports work.
Put them a half point closer.
It put them a half point closer. It didn't make a difference. That is not why the Americans lost. But since it did get a little closer there at the end, that rule now really comes into the fray of conversation and discussion, and that rule's got to be changed. If you're only as good as your availability. You know, it would have been great to have Jaden Daniels on Sunday at Atlanta. Probably would have been a different outcome. Maybe not. But you never know, and you can't just give a half point to the Europeans when Victor Hovland couldn't play. That's wrong. I think everybody knows it's wrong, and I think it's going to be changed.
Yeah, it was absurd. I mean, and it means a lot, even, you know, if it's, you know, 10-6, you know, at the end of Saturday, or 9-7. But when you put a team that is at 11.5 and 2.5 points away from retaining the cup, a half point closer, it was absurd. It's almost like juice boxes and goldfish time for,
that's
as you
exactly
said,
right,
Little League players.
Now,
it has to be changed.
I totally agree. But here's the thing that I think, in my opinion, sounds like your opinion as well, there's no debate that the team that has the player who can't go should not earn a half point. I think that's really not up for debate. What is up for debate is what should happen in that match. Should they only have 27 points instead of 28 and not have that match count at all? Should the other side get a full point? Because let's face it, in tennis, one-on-one, mano-a-mano, woman against woman, if a player has to withdraw or has an injury or can't go, the other player advances to the next round. So that's up for debate, whether the Americans should have gotten
the
point.
Well, that's the correct answer.
Half point.
If Victor Hovland plays for the European team and can't go due to injury, then it's a walkover. It's a default. And Harris English wins that match, and the U.S. is awarded a point.
Well,
that's competition.
If that's exactly right. In my opinion, now you could debate that side of it, what should happen with that half point or full point. But to me, giving a half point to a team that has a player who can't go is 100% wrong. Just think about this. In all other aspects of golf, if you just want to do apples to apples, because golf, you know, all the way down the line, can't compare it to tennis or the other sports, whatever, because you can't do that to the other sports either. But in this particular sport, Kevin, if you're playing the junior amateur, if you're playing the mid-am, if you're playing the U.S. amateur, the U.S. women's amateur, if you can't go, that other player wins the match. So in the Dell match play, remember when it used to be in Austin and La Costa,
yep,
the WGC Dell match play championship? If a player couldn't go, the other player would advance. Now, this isn't advancing. This is a point system in the Ryder
Cup. It's not a bracket.
But I'm with you 100%. If another player can't go for whatever reason, I don't think there should be an alternate. I don't think there should be any other scenario other than the other team gets the full point. By the way, I love Victor Hovland, and I'm not questioning him at all because he is a gamer and he's a great guy. But he didn't have a problem lifting the Ryder Cup when they won. He didn't have a problem drinking beer when he won. So, you know, it's not like he's going across the middle on third and six here. Let's tee it up and see what happens.
Right. We're talking to Steve Sands. So before we get to the lack of drama on the first 2 days and the drama on the last day, you were there. Tell us about the Bethpage Black New York crowd, which got a lot of criticism, including from Tom Watson, who basically apologized to the Europeans for the behavior of the American fans in New York.
I thought it was embarrassing for the Americans. I thought the United States embarrassed itself with some of the language. Look, me and you were huge sports fans. You know, I've heard it all at sporting events, and we heard it all last week. I have no problem with people roughing people up, people having a good time, people drinking too much, people saying things that might be a tad inappropriate or a tad coarse, or throw out a curse word in front of a little kid or an old lady, whatever you want to do. But if you're chucking beers at Erica McIlroy, if you're saying things that are so personal in their personal life. Now, I get it. They're public figures. They're athletes. And fans can say whatever they want. But have some class. And, you know, have a little bit of grace. Have fun. You know, there was a great moment where Rory was trying to button his button. And, you know, we've all been there. We're all trying to button a button with one hand. And we're not be able to get it in there. We're wiggling around like a four-year-old who's got to go pee and that kind of thing. And this fan yells, "You don't need a button to choke, Rory." That's sports. That's sports fans. That's fun.
Yeah.
Rory laughed his butt off. Tyrrell Hatton was laughing. Shane Lowry was laughing. That's cool. But to just say horrific, crass, rude things, to me, that's just not being a sports fan. That's social media and people being idiots and that kind of stuff. And the other thing is, the PGA of America, now it wasn't just the fans who embarrassed the United States of America around the world at this massive global sporting event. It's a huge, huge global sporting event. The PGA of America, Kevin, hired a woman to be kind of the person on the first tee to kind of get people jacked up, kind of like,
right,
you know, like a DJ kind of thing. But she's a comedian, kind of actress, I think, is what she does for a living. And she's yelling "F you, Rory" to the crowd to get them riled up. What are we doing here? I mean, Rory McIlroy is standing
on the first tee,
Kevin. She had to be removed from the position. She was not fired or let go, whatever you want to call it. But whatever she was not there on Sunday because, hey, what are we doing here? I mean, it's sports, for goodness sakes. Have fun. Have a great time. Drink all you want. And rough up whoever player you want to rough up. But, man, oh, man, have some class, for goodness sakes.
So I hear you completely, and I think that was part of the story going in, is what was this crowd going to be like? Because we as American sports fans understand that the New York sports fan is a bit different. Philly, yep, New York, a bit different than kind of everybody else's, which, by the way, is what makes our favorite Maryland basketball fan base so great. There's a lot of Jersey, New York, and Philadelphia in it because so many of those kids that go to Maryland are from there. You know, I would say this, they shouldn't bring their families to this event. It's just like Coach K stopped letting the Krzyzewskis go to Kohl Fieldhouse and Comcast Center, and Mrs. Boozer, you know, and everybody else, they understood what the landscape would be like. I think they should have had a little bit more of self-awareness, and families probably shouldn't have been there for the European players.
Yeah, I'm with you on everything until that last part. I mean, look, you and I are both good friends with, you know, some of these Maryland coaches and what they've had, and what Dana Williams had to hear, what Ann Turgeon had to hear, you know, what Kevin Willard's wife had to hear and their kids had to hear. I get all that. But it wasn't directed at them. It was directed at the coaches, whether it was Cole or Xfinity or the players, whatever it is. When you have the family thing is part of the Ryder Cup. That's the deal. And it's always been that way. You know, the parents are inside the ropes. I was with Jerry McIlroy last week, having to hear his son hear things that you would never in your life want to hear. Again, this is out of the sports realm. I'm not trying to be soft. And I know we're a little softer in D.C. than they are in Philly and New York. I get that. But I'm not trying to be soft. I think it's fair game to say whatever you want. But if you want to act like a buffoon like that, that's your prerogative too. And I think that should be called out. And I think just the United States around the world, people were watching it going, okay, well, I mean, what? Give me a break here. Like, it was just a little over the top. That's all.
Yeah. We're talking to Steve Sands. So, certainly Shane Lowry on, when he closed out Henley, said it will not be the same at Adair. Adair is one of the most beautiful.
I don't know about that, Kevin. I've been to
especially the Irish, right?
Give me a break. I don't know if there'll be the personal attacks, but I promise you, I have been to a lot of Ryder Cups on international soil in Europe. I'm telling you, Kevin, I know it won't be as bad, so Shane is technically right, but believe me, the Irish will get jacked up for that.
By the way, for those of you who don't know, we are 12 years away. Hopefully we're all around for it.
Oh, yeah.
From the Ryder Cup being played at Congressional, which will be insane. All right.
And by the way, we love D.C., and we are homers to the core. They'll rough up the Europeans that week, too.
Have you ever seen on Friday and Saturday that many putts go down? It seemed like every single time they lined up for, you know, anywhere from an 8-footer to an 18-footer, they just were all going in.
I was in the booth Friday morning when we came on the air. We brought us on the air. It was me and Terry Gannon doing the play-by-play with Nick Faldo and Noda Begay. And about halfway through.
By the way, the audio was a bit off. I don't know if you guys knew that. It was a bit frustrating. The audio was lagging.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
We know about it. we heard all about it. Obviously, that's really no one in particular's fault, but we heard. We definitely heard about it, without question, from friends like you and plenty of others. About halfway through the morning session, so we came on the air at 7, first ball on the air at 7:10, place is raucous, everybody's going crazy. At about 9 a.m., we're in commercial, and I look over at Faldo and I go, I mean, Nick Faldo is one of the greatest players in the history of the sport. And I look over at Faldo and I go, what is going on here? He's like, it's just one of those days. And he's like, I'm not sure I've ever seen anything like this before. And we've seen a lot of Europeans make a lot of putts, Ian Poulter, Sergio Garcia, down the line. But Friday morning was like the Americans just got roundhouse, Kevin. I mean, they got bullied. It was nuts, and they're not better players. They're just better at this entire thing. That's it.
All right. Well, let's go to Sunday, and there's no chance. And then the half point awarded to each team because of the Hovland injury, it's 12-5. They need 14 to retain the cup. The U.S. needs 14.5. So it's a foregone conclusion that the Europeans are going to retain the cup, and probably by a sizable margin. As the day unfolds, when did you have kind of a sense that maybe there's a chance here? I mean, you know what? I want to back up. How badly did Scheffler need to win that match head up against Rory?
Had to beat it. The Americans had to win those first few matches just to see some red on the board And yeah. I'm always fascinated. I've told you this before. I'm fascinated in sports at momentum, especially in golf. I get it in other sports.
Right.
But in golf, momentum, it just, I'm not a psychology major. It just intrigues me how and why there can possibly be momentum in golf. But yet there is. So you see those early guys on the board. The Americans stacked the lineup. They had to put Red on the board early, and they did. So the Scheffler match versus Rory was massive. But there's always, I said this on Saturday, and I said this on Sunday morning. I said it on Sunday when we came on the air at noon, just before the first ball went in the air. There's always a day, no matter what the score is, there's always about 30 or 45 minutes on Sunday at the Ryder Cup where you look up and go, well, if that goes that way, if that goes that way, if that goes that way, they got a chance. So to me, the entire day was get off to a good start for the Americans, which they did, and then the Lowry match was the key. If Lowry misses that putt on 18, Kevin,
yeah.
The Americans, I'm not going to say probably.
If Henley makes
won,
the putt, let's start with that, because he left the last Henley, two on 16, on 17
correct.
And 18 short.
But it was Lowry before that. If he doesn't do what he did on 18,
yeah.
Then I have no idea what's going to happen after that with Henley and Griffin and those guys. But the
Well, Henley was matched up against Lowry. I'm saying Henley could have closed him out by making that putt at 17, and then he left the one at 18 short as well.
He could have, but he didn't. And the key to that point was is that I know Henley missed on 16 and 17 and had a chance to close it out. But if Lowry doesn't sneak that in there, then that changes the entire narrative of everything that's behind
sure.
them. And that was enormous. Now, it was the clinching point, and I get that. But if he doesn't turn that around there, I think that is probably going to be the greatest comeback in the history of the Ryder Cup. In my estimation, as we were looking at the board, but it's a weird deal with momentum. The players see that red on the board, the players see the blue on the board, and they don't play any harder, they don't try any harder, but they're just feeling it, and it's just like every other sport. And the Henley Lowry match for us when we were on the air on Sunday, that was the match. As everything was unfolding, everybody during commercial break kept saying, "Oh, this is the one that's going to matter the most."
Right.
And Henley was up, and he was on 16 and had a chance to win it.
Yeah.
Then we were all like, wow, the Americans are actually going to come all the way back here. But he didn't close it out on 16. It's not Russell's fault that they lost. But collectively, the Americans lost it. But that match was the key.
I totally agree, but I'm just curious. Were you and the others weren't I was like confident Lowry when he got to 18 was like this guy just delivers all the time.
Yes.
I did not think there was a chance he was going to miss that putt. Did you?
Well, I had the odd holes. So on 16, I thought to myself, if Russell doesn't win this, Shane Lowry's going to steal it. And Russell didn't close it out. He couldn't close it out. And I remember thinking on 17, Russell had another chance at the par three to get it done. And didn't. And when it got to 18, wasn't my hole. And I was just kind of sitting there watching it. And I'm like, you know what? Shane Lowry's going to close this out because that's what Shane Lowry does. Not that he is the greatest player in the history of the sport, but for whatever reason, when the money's on the line, Kevin, Shane usually comes up big, and he certainly
God, he
did
does.
This. Oh, man, he does.
You talked about the pressure. Scheffler. On it was on Saturday, I'm pretty sure. I think it was the Saturday four ball. It may have been the Saturday foursome. He shanked a shot on 18. He literally shanked one like any of us would. That's Scotty Scheffler. I was like, oh my God, they feel this more than any other event they play.
It's unlike any other event because it's an individual sport, and once a year you're playing with the team. Your schedule's a little bit off. Your preparation's a little bit off because you're not doing it the way you want to do it. You're doing it the way the team needs to do it. That, to me, is the biggest problem the Americans have. They overthink this thing, Kevin. It's golf. Fred Couples won three straight President's Cups. Different event, President's Cup versus Ryder Cup. I get it. But the philosophy, Fred, imposes on his players and his team is the correct way. Alleviate all the pressure. You handle all the heat and go tell your 12 guys, by the way, 12 of the greatest players in the world, go tell the 12 guys, play golf. I got everything else. Who you want to play with? How do you want to practice? Go ahead. Go play. Don't force tee times. Don't force partners. Don't force practice routines. I know you have to do a dinner and you got to do an opening ceremony, so it's a little bit thrown off. But, you know, if Scottie Scheffler likes to wake up and work out and then go eat something and then go chip and pitch and then go back inside or whatever he does as a routine, let him do his routine for the most part. Scheffler and all the American players felt the pressure, and they always do. And the Americans put more pressure on themselves last week, at the Ryder Cup than any other time they play golf. And that includes major championships because it's not just them. It's their partner. It's their team. It's their captain. And it's the America on their red, white, and blue everywhere. It's difficult. But Scotty was 0-4, you know, Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
The number one player in the world. The Americans ended up losing by 2, and Scotty was 0-4 the first 2 days. You realize if one of those points flips, it's a tie. Now, they would have retained the cup, Europe would have, if they would have tied. But right. That's how close this thing usually is. One match flips, and all of a sudden things change quite a bit. And Scotty just didn't deliver last week. He did not play very well. That shot in particular was probably made a lot of us feel good, but that was a very difficult thing for Scotty.
All right, three quick ones to end it with you, and we'll talk football the next time you're on. Who was the star of this past weekend? Who was the biggest disappointment? And then what do we make of Keegan Bradley after all is said and done?
Well, the biggest disappointment, unfortunately, has to be Scotty when he only comes up with 1 point. The Americans lost by 2, and he's the best player on the planet by far, and he did not perform very well. Now, there's other things involved in that, but him particularly, he just didn't play great golf, his best golf, which is a shame. I thought the hero, that's the biggest disappointment of the week for the 24 players. I thought Tommy Fleetwood and Cameron Young were the two best players out there. God, Cameron Young played well, Kevin.
Yep.
And man, he should have been out there on the first tee as a New Yorker on Friday morning with Bryson DeChambeau and let it rip and let's get the momentum going, get red on the board, and let's crank it out. He played fabulous last week, and so did Tommy Fleetwood on the other side. As far as Keegan goes, very difficult spot for a contemporary, like I said earlier, 39 years of age. He plays with these guys. You know, usually the captain is a half generation ahead, like Luke Donald, you know, is in his 40s while the other guys are much younger. They all know each other, but it's not the same when you're playing with and against these guys all the time. I thought he made a couple of choices that were interesting. The setup of the golf course was a little bit easier than it probably should have been. I know why. They didn't want it to be a slugfest like a PGA Championship at Bethpage or a U.S. Open at Bethpage, but it was set up a little bit easier than it should have been. I thought he should have been playing, but by definition, when you're the 13th ranked player in the world and you're a top 12 player in the United States and you don't play, by definition, you're making the team worse. And the other thing is, if you're going to have Bryson DeChambeau from LIV on the team, which is perfectly fine, he should have been on the team, I would have put Brooks Koepka on that team. He won the PGA in Bethpage Black. He is a bad man on the golf course, if there is such a thing in this sport. He's won 5 major championships. He is not afraid of the moment. And to me, there was just a lot of factors involved there. But Keegan was fine. The players didn't perform. And there were some interesting decisions made. But Keegan was put in a very difficult position.
All right. Thanks for doing this, as always. We'll talk football next time. Appreciate it.
Big spot Sunday, man. Need to go to L.A. and win.
I think they might.
I know. I saw the lines, only 2.5. I like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
I like that.
We think similarly. All right, I'll talk to you later. Thanks for doing this.
All right, my man. Be good.
Steve Sands, everybody. When we come back, what did you learn from this past weekend? It can be about our team. It can be about anything sports-related, anything NFL-related, anything college football-related. What did you learn from this?
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Past weekend, 301-230-0980. I've got two of them for you when we come back.
The new president of baseball operations for your Washington Nationals, Paul Tomoni, who once played for the Hawaii Allies?
Elite East.
Good Hawaiian, JP. Good pronunciation.
Does it look like it. Allies?
I don't know. We're just trying to get to know him a little bit here during the break and everything. And he played college, but like, he didn't really highlight that. You know, they highlight what you've been doing with the Red Sox and your rise from intern now to president of baseball ops. But before that, you were a ball player.
Yep.
I kind of got that feeling when you were talking about tag plays and stuff.
I care about that. Those sort of small things. But, yeah, it's funny you mentioned the Hawaii Lees. That was, like, one of the best summers of my life. That was after my freshman year of college, maybe. Uh-huh. And they had us in a hotel right by Waikiki Beach, and I remember, like, Jock Peterson was just out of high school living right down the hall.
Jeez.
And, I mean, just a ton of great people and great players that it made for a really fun summer. So,
I would imagine.
Yeah.
It is amazing. His
summer
run
in Hawaii.
Yeah, it must be nice.
But, I mean, this guy's a brainiac. He went to Cal, mm-hmm. then he goes to Notre Dame. I was telling him, you know, Mike Bray is a good friend of mine, and he's a Hoops fan, so he knows who Mike is. And I was telling him that I talked to Mike about you being hired, and he said, well, tell him that I got a hookup for tickets. If you want to go to Hawks games, you got a hookup too, because he's an assistant with the Hawks, but he wants to come up.
Come on, he's all things D.C. He's going to want to go to Wizards games and now Caps games. He's here in D.C. now.
But he's a Washingtonian as well. But yeah. I wanted to ask you, how did this all come about? I mean, obviously, you were doing a great job in scouting with Boston, and I'm a Boston fan. I told you this all fair, so I kind of know all the young players. But how did this come about? With getting in touch with the Lerner family, the ownership group?
Yeah, so how it works in baseball is basically, it was as quick as this. Like, I'm sitting in my office one day, and Craig Breslow comes walking in and is like, hey, got some news for you. Mm-hmm. The Washington Nationals have asked to talk with you about their top baseball job. And so then I go home to my wife that night and talk it over, like, is this something that we'd be interested in, so on and so forth. And then it just kind of rolls from there.
Right, so they reached out to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have an agent?
No, you know, I honestly just, it's funny how all this stuff works. Like, for whatever reason, baseball agency, like for executives, isn't all that common. So, but in other sports, football, basketball, it's pretty darn common.
So I didn't hear the entire presser, but I wanted to ask you, you're the president of baseball ops. Are you thinking of hiring a GM underneath you, or are you just going to run the show from your title?
So still TBD, what I feel really good about is I have the full support of ownership. Like if I believe that that's the best thing for the Washington Nationals, then they're totally good with it. But I got to get to know these folks first,
right,
before making that decision. And there's a chance we do and a chance we don't.
Who are these folks?
Really everyone in the front office throughout the organization, all of our scouts, all of our coaches, you know, our R&D folks, everyone. I know there's a lot of people working within this group. I've only been here for a couple of days. I've tried to chip away, but it's going to take some time.
Paul, one of the things that jumped out at me at your presser was your quote, and I see it here on MLB.com also. I think it starts with creating a scouting and player development monster as far as, like, building things here. And that's a little surprising coming from somebody of your age group. A lot of people, fair or unfair, are going to say, well, he's going to be an analytics-first guy. Scouting's going to go by the wayside. But that's something that's really hugely important.
That was
to you
his strength.
And your staff, yeah, obviously, that you're going to build here in Washington.
Yeah. You know, I was an area scout, so I have great respect for the job that scouts do, the great respect for the job that coaches do in player development, obviously. But I'm also a huge believer in the power of analytics, and mm-hmm. I think you know, that can be integrated really, really well into the scouting and player development spaces. And we can get folks working together that, to me, that's where the magic happens. Like if, I hate to say it, but like if you are just, you know, you got a scouting group or player development group that are just totally turned off by analytics, like it's going to be really, really hard to get success in today's game.
What was your perception of the Nationals from the outside when it comes to that department?
You know, I think back to what a great franchise it is, thinking back to 2019, like them having won. For whatever reason, like, you know, I have a ton of relationships across the game. I didn't have a ton of relationships within the Nationals organization. So not that I have a positive or negative reaction to what the Nationals were doing. I just didn't really have a reaction.
So one of the things we talked about during the season, and we were friends with Mike Rizzo. Mike would come on our show every week. Hopefully you'll come on our show every week. It was good to kind of get to know him, was, and you've talked about assurances, but we were kind of saying it's a little bit nebulous to us. And one thing specifically that the Washington Post wrote about is that most of the league had used something called the trajectory arc machine, whatever, and the Nationals didn't have that. And it was like a little indicator, maybe, maybe not, that maybe they're just not spending like the rest of the franchises and the rest of the organizations, which are spending on some of the technology now that's available for players. Did you get a chance to talk to ownership about things like that?
Yeah, we didn't like dive into like the nitty gritty details about like, you know, are we going to have a traject and is it going to be in West Palm? Is it going to be in DC? Is it going to be in both spaces, more spaces? What we did talk about though is like, you know, the resources that they provide to build out a great infrastructure. And like I said in the presser, like I'm in the seat for a reason. I feel pretty good about it.
All right, got to ask you this. All right, because Nats fans that we've talked to over the last 5 years since they won the World Series were frustrated because the payroll has dipped considerably. And in the playoffs this year, you know this, 9 of the top 15 payrolls are in the playoffs. The three teams that aren't are Milwaukee, Cincinnati, and Cleveland. And Cleveland's way down, but they've got a star player and some really good young pitchers. But even when you were in Boston, you did a great job scouting and drafting guys like Roman Anthony, who's going to be a star. But Boston also went out and got Bregman, and they went out and got Giolito, and they made the trade for, you know, Crochet. I mean, they went out and got stars. You have to couple that with your strength. What would you tell Nats fans about, you know, a possible increase in the payroll and spending more money on free agents, or have you not talked to the learner ownership group about that yet?
No, I think more than anything is like repeating kind of what I just said, which is like I feel great support, right?
Okay.
So, you know, yeah, is it easier to win if you're spending a lot of money in free agency? Yes, that is like objectively true, right?
Right.
You just reference all the teams in playoffs that spend a lot of money. But to us, like, just put that aside for a second, right? Like, I think the cleanest path to winning and creating a sustainable winner is, you know, identifying, acquiring, developing talent. So regardless of like what our payroll situation is, like, you have to dominate that to be a contender in the playoffs.
Gotcha.
Talking to Paul Taboni, he is the new Nationals president of baseball operations. We got a lot of questions from our listeners. Let's talk about manager. How do you go about making that decision? Do you have a list? Some people have tweeted us. Does he have a list? Like, what is your
thinking? There's some big names
manager
available now too. Yeah.
Yeah. I've gone back and forth with Miguel a decent amount in the early going. That said, like, I feel like I said this two or three times in the presser. I didn't mean to be dodging. It's just the truth of it all. I've only been in the seat for a couple of days.
It's
right?
too early, yeah.
So I'm looking forward to talking to Miguel. And then once I have that conversation, I think it'll be clear kind of where we're going. But more than anything, like, I would want Miguel to hear from me first, like how I'm thinking through it. I think he deserves that.
All right, so a philosophy thing, and you told us you had a story, so I'm going to kind of set you up. There's the philosophy, and I think somebody asked you, actually our pal Ryan, who works at the station, mm-hmm. about kind of a kind of an identity for the organization, and he mentioned Tampa and the identity they have. Sometimes you can be an organization that flips prospects for great players. The Boston Red Sox did that. Give us your Crochet story. You said you had to then tell four players that they'd been traded who were looking to be the future of the Red Sox.
Yeah. So, like, once again, I go back to the importance of, like, identifying, acquiring, and developing players, right? Like, the reason why the Red Sox were able to make that Crochet deal was because they had Kyle Teal and Braden Montgomery and Chase Myatt-Roth and Wickelman Gonzalez to deal for Crochet, right? So when that deal went down, you know how it is. Like when you're overseeing player development, you grow really close with these players, right? And so I was close with really all.
And you're a young guy, so it's not like a 70-year-old GM dealing with these guys.
Yeah, they tell me
a guy who played.
That they probably shouldn't tell me, which I love. You know, like, I just want them to.
You're one of the guys. You're in the mix. Okay.
Yeah, I think part of it too is just feeling comfy in a clubhouse too, and this probably comes from my playing background, whatever it is. Like, they just trust you because I think they over time they realize like I'm a normal dude and I like hanging out and BSing with them and that sort of thing. So, but going back to the story, you know, I'm laughing, but at the time it was painful. So I'm calling, you know, all four of those guys to let them know that they've been traded. And I call Kyle. So he was just here playing with the White Sox, mm-hmm. right? He's catching for him. Mm-hmm. Amazing, amazing kid. Like one of my favorites I've ever had. And so he answers the phone. And I'm thinking to myself, like, gosh, how is he going to receive this? He absolutely loved it within the Red Sox organization, right? And so I call him and I'm like, he answers and he goes, T-Bone, what's up, baby? And I'm like, okay, too. Like, what do I say?
I got to break the news to him. This could be tough.
Right.
Yeah. And so I break the news to him, and he was just like silent for a period of time. I felt so bad for him. But, you know, we ended up hanging up from the call and connecting later that day. And I think it ended up being an unbelievable thing for Kyle. Like, you've seen what he's done this year. He's playing his butt off, and he's going to be a really good player in the big leagues for a long period of time.
Do you bristle at all at the Theo Epstein comps, or is that like a trailblazer for you, like for baseball teams to hire young, up-and-coming executives to entrust them for the whole process?
Yeah.
Like, do you have a weird thing with the Theo Epstein comps, or is that like a flattery to you?
No, I think I haven't heard them first of all. But you know, when I hear that, I'm just like, gosh, that's you know, that's aggressive. Not because I don't believe in myself. Like, I mean, I got all the belief in the world myself. But Theo's like one of, if not the greatest, to ever do it. Mm-hmm. Right? It's in our world, it's kind of like I don't know, comparing a first year NBA guy to Michael Jordan, right? Like,
right.
It's just a really lofty comparison, and I have all the respect in the world for Theo. So. I think you got to do a little bit more.
You got to earn it. Yeah.
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 How much you talked about it in the presser? How much did you learn from just working in that organization from guys like Breslow, Craig Breslow, who's in your position up in Boston? How much did they kind of direct you?
Yeah. So it's funny. Like I spent all but 3 months of my 11-year career with the Red Sox, right?
Right.
But it was interesting in that it almost felt like I worked for four different teams because I had Ben Sherrington, and then I had Dave Dombrowski, and then I had Chaim Bloom and Brian O'Halloran.
You had a lot of guys,
I had Brez. And so, you know, those guys came from different organizations. Chaim came from Tampa Bay. Obviously, Brez came from Chicago, the Cubs. And so, you know, I think you're able to take like a little piece of all their leadership styles, right? But you're also able to take like, hey the Cubs were doing it this way, or Tampa Bay was doing it this way, right? And you're like, hey, I'm going to kind of put that in my tool belt going forward. And so that perspective, like, I don't take for granted, because there are a lot of organizations in baseball, right, that there's very little turnover, right? And they don't get to experience that like refreshed look. And while like, you know, going through those changes always, it's tough, right? Like you end up benefiting from it in some regard.
Right.
Talking to Paul Taboni, he's the new president of baseball operations here for the Washington Nationals. When did you get your hair cut? Because I'm looking on the screen and I'm right next to you. He's got like this line right here. Like the barber did a really good job.
Thanks, man. That's you'll laugh at this. We'll give a shout out to Phoenix Barbershop in Everett, Massachusetts.
So, oh, there you go. Was it yesterday?
It was, what would it have been, 3 or 4 days ago. I took my kids to get their hair cut.
Like he's got like this line right here. Like that I don't think most people usually have. He probably took the straight edge razor.
Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to ask you just real quickly before we go. What do you think of this Nationals roster? So you've got some young guys like James Wood, CJ Abrams, Dalen Lyle was the National League. Player of the Month, not just Rookie of the Month, Player of the Month. What do you think of some of the young players that are here?
Speaking of Dalen, I don't know if you guys saw that tweet the other day, but Sarah Langs, who I think is awesome, she sent out a tweet that I might get this wrong, but he had, I think, 7 triples and 6 homers in the month of September. The last player to do that was Willie Mays in like June of 57 or something. So
pretty good player.
Yeah, good comp.
Cool. Yeah, and just I think it, you know, once again speaks to Daylon's upside, and but obviously not just Daylon. Like I think about, you know, obviously James and CJ and Dylan and McKenzie. I mean, there's so many players you can name. That part of it is really exciting to me, right?
The cupboard's not bare.
No, not at all. And I think, you know, I mentioned those names. Like, there are other folks on the roster that I'm really looking forward to working with because I'm hoping we can pull more out of them. But I think the same with them. I said it at the press conference. Like, they're already really talented players. Like, my hope is that we can tap into more.
Jason played basketball with James Wood's dad, right?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
He was at Richmond when I was there, yeah. But James is a stud. Obviously, you mentioned Dale and stud. Dylan Cruz had the injury this year.
The thing
I also had the question for you was Mackenzie Gore, who didn't have a good year in terms of record, and he, you know, obviously he's not getting a lot of run support. He pitched really well in a lot of games, but his contract's coming up, and that's something I know you've thought about. Do you think about, hey, all right, we got a lot of contracts that we might have to sign. Is ownership going to be behind us when it comes to signing long-term deals, especially for pitchers?
Yeah, you know, like going back to what I said before, like this is whatever it is, the third day in the organization.
Yeah,
right?
So still
like,
early. Yeah.
I still, you know, I've texted back and forth with him. I knew him a little bit as an amateur player. I saw him at I think it was Whiteville High School in North Carolina. Like Mackenzie, you know, I think the world of from the outside, but I still haven't really learned him as a person.
Right.
And I haven't gotten others' opinions in the organization. So we'll just take it day by day and come to learn these players. And then hopefully, I said it, we can just make good decisions over and over and over again going forward.
Gotcha.
Well, Paul, let me just point out that our studio is just two blocks from here. You just walk right down the street. We'll have an open door. You come by, hang out. We talk basketball.
All right. Sweet.
Yeah. We don't have to talk any Nats. We talk basketball.
Yeah, but we're not playing one-on-one with you. You're 20 years younger than us. We just can't hang. Well, I heard you talking about keeping score, being competitive during the presser. So no playing one-on-one. You can do that
one-on-one game against our former
intern. You do that with the younger set.
It didn't go well.
Yeah, it didn't go well. Not going to do that
again. All right, that's Paul Taboni. He is the new president of baseball operations for your Washington Nationals.
It is a Scotty's Vodka Red Bull Friday. Listen, it's Friday, and a lot of our focus is on Sunday. Commanders taking on the Chargers out here in Los Angeles.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm watching as the sun is rising on the West Coast, shaping up to be a beautiful day in Southern California. It usually is. You know where else it's going to be a beautiful day? College Park, Maryland. Tomorrow, Saturday, the Terps, 4-0, undefeated, stud freshman quarterback Malik Washington hosting the Washington Huskies. Joining us now is my friend Joe LeBou from the Maryland Athletic Department. Joe Boo, what up, dude?
What's going on, man? This is fun to talk to you in an official capacity. This is a good time, man. How you been?
I am good, brother. I am good. So, dude, I want people understand this. Like, we had Jim Smith, the Terps' new athletic director, on the line maybe last week, and you know, Jim's coming from where he worked for the Falcons. He worked for Ohio State. Like, he chose to come to Maryland. You worked for the Capitals. You worked for the Skins. You worked for the Panthers. You chose to come back to Maryland. What are you guys trying to build in College Park and get that athletic department really kind of humming?
Championship culture. You know, I came back because And I've told people this, JP, like, it's not aspirational. I mean, you and I, when we were here, we were on the top of the mountain in a lot of sports. We mean something to the DMV. We mean something to alum and fans. And I think, you know, having been in the professional side for 24 years, we are that old. having an opportunity to come back and make a legitimate impact at a place that I care about, my friends care about, my family cares about, is the opportunity of a lifetime. And with the evolving landscape of college athletics, you know, we're the right people for the role.
What is it that makes us feel like this is the right time for things to start hitting at University of Maryland?
Yeah, you know, we've got an amazing alumni base. We're in the most powerful region in the country. We play in what we consider to be the best conference in the country. And, you know, you've seen the talent coming through here. You've seen all of the ingredients are here to put Maryland on a map locally and nationally. And I just, there's so much opportunity. And anytime you want to take a shot at something, you look at sort of risk reward. And for me, yeah, there's a little bit of risk, but man, the reward is just so great. Mm-hmm. And you'll see it. I mean, we've got a freshman quarterback, local guy, doing big things. Who doesn't want to be a part of that? You know, the basketball team coming off that, it sort of woke up everybody. It woke up me in Charlotte last year. You know, the group text, people I went to school with, everyone was talking about
you and I,
Maryland,
dude.
Basketball again. Yeah, it's great. You and I were texting back and forth for sure. I mean, like, you know, that stuff is why we do what we do, right? And to be able to now be right here, sort of woven in the fabric, is pretty amazing.
Dude, how difficult is the new college sports landscape? Like, just how complicated? I don't know the right way to describe it, but just, like, what is your day-to-day like trying to just cope, I suppose?
You make it sound so difficult. I don't think it's as difficult as some may think, because again, from my perspective, you know, the priorities are the priorities, and that's to deliver best in class fan experience, best in class environment for our student athletes, make sure from a reputational standpoint, University of Maryland's, you know, the best in class. Those were all things that we did day in and day out where we were before. You know, every decision you make, you know, you stand to be criticized or applauded for it. You have to weigh those things out. And for me, you know, I look at it from a revenue standpoint. You know, how do we become resourced in a better way? And I think the sort of wild west part of this is people's understanding of how do I become involved? You know, what is NIL? What is rev share? Are they the same? I don't get it. You know, and just letting people know there are several ways to be involved. You can buy tickets and show up tomorrow, you know, and that investment is going right back into the university. It's going right back into our facilities. It's going right back into rosters and out. So you do play that role. And there's a little bit different value prop than the pro side, you know, and that's what's exciting about this too. So for me, I think just prioritizing getting people here, getting them engaged, and then the secret sauce, JPs, you know, it's like getting them to come back, getting them to feel great about Maryland. You know, if we're gonna press the foot down on the revenue side, we want to make sure that value is reciprocated, and that's what we're doing. So the first 2 months here has been just evaluating what we've been doing, what's working, where the opportunities are, where are some early wins. You know, getting a sellout tomorrow—that's a massive early win for us. But a lot of little things behind the scenes too that maybe people don't notice, but, you know, sort of some of the parts, that a lot of things are happening.
How much fun are you having getting all this stuff done? And I mean, it's like a first for a lot of people. It's a first for a lot of programs, but if you do it right, it can be something that lasts a long time.
That's it. I mean, it's all about the impact. I mean, for me, there's a professional piece to it, but a lot of it's personal too. And you're right. The impact is great. And if you can impact a place you care about, what
what better way to spend your day and your time? Because as you guys both know, this industry is a grind. You know, you're away from your family quite a bit. It's 24/7, 365. As much as you want to unplug, it's impossible. So, you know, you want to make sure you're at a place that you love and you believe in. You know, somebody told me a long time ago, the biggest thing of sales is believing in your product, and there's no product I believe in more than the University of Maryland.
I mean, hell, you were B. You want to know something about Joe Boo?
What you got?
Unlike me, Joe Boo and I would go to the bars frequently. We would go out a lot, but Joe was able Joe was able to maintain what, a 4.0, like a 3.7. My GPA was a little bit different.
I thought you were going to tell everybody how great of a flag football athlete I was. You know, 4 titles in 4 years, Harry.
Pretty elite. Pretty elite. He's got quicks, B. He's got quicks. How close is that thing to a sellout tomorrow? Is it sold out?
We're less than 2,000 seats away. So yesterday was massive gains.
JB, buy that up, man.
that's a B-Mitch salary to buy up 2,000 tickets. Yeah. That ain't a big-eared blogger, B.
So we're pacing really well. I mean, the ticket buyer these days, they love to wait until day of or, you know, day before. So we really anticipate being able to announce a sellout. I think I would be disappointed if we didn't at this point, the way things are moving. So fingers crossed, if people are listening, engaging now, there's still opportunity to come out here. It's going to be beautiful weather. It will be the Los Angeles of the Mid-Atlantic tomorrow. And
I love that.
3:30 kick. Let's go. I mean, get to College Park early. Enjoy it. The sights, the sounds, the smells. You know,
easy on the smells. I've walked around College Park lately. It doesn't exactly the smells can be quite interesting.
That's true. except for a game day.
Tailgates, grills.
You got the grills going on early. Yeah, exactly. There's nothing like it. You guys know that.
Dude, I assume you saw this. Did you see Jaden Daniels showing some love to Malik Washington? What do you think that means?
Of course I did.
What do you think that means to the kid, the player, and then what does that mean for the program?
I think it shows how important we are. It also shows what a tight-knit community, you know, sports can be. And, you know, people support those that they believe in and they see big things. It puts Malik in that category of must see and must support. And for Jay to do that speaks volumes about him too and how he's assimilated into the DMV. And, you know, he wants to be a part of this too. And I think that's great. And that's something that, you know, Commanders fans can get behind, and they know they've got their guy as QB1. So it was really cool.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. What is Malik like? I've met him briefly. I imagine you dealt with him and talked to him a fair amount. It seems like a great kid. He's clearly a great player.
The maturity level, JT, is off the charts. I mean, I've been around pro athletes my whole life, and, you know, I haven't seen many more mature than Malik is, and he's wise beyond his years. But it was funny, if you're around him for just a couple minutes, just kind of seeing how he interacts with people and sort of the questions he asks you, it's not surprising that he can command a huddle. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising that, you know, he's got the offense humming the way it is, and he's got the belief of our coaching staff as a true freshman.
All right, man. Go Terps. A fun one tomorrow. Let's get a dub over these Huskies.
Let's do it.
Hey, we got to have bragging rights over Kerwin.
That's right. Well, no, he's a Wisconsin. Oh,
that's right, Wisconsin. I forgot. I'm thinking the W.
But whatever. We need bragging rights over Kerwin regardless. Joe Boo, thank you, buddy.
Thanks, guys.
All right, man. That's our friend Joe LeBou from the University of Maryland Athletic Department. We're giving away Terps tickets right now. Caller number 10. You can win a pair of tickets to tomorrow's game, Terps versus Huskies. Big opportunity for Maryland to go to 2-0 in the Big Ten. First time Maryland's ever hosted the Huskies.
And to start on Virginia Tech football, we've got the voice of the Hokies, the great Bill Roth, with us.
Bill, don't look now, but break up the boys. They've hung 38-23 in wins the last couple of weeks. They leveled up and beat NC State, going it back to their last outing, and now they've got Wake Forest coming to town to look to win three in a row here. What can you tell us about the 1 o'clock kick tomorrow in Blacksburg?
Well, the Hokies have never gone from 0-3 to 3-3, and that is an unusual occurrence, and that's what they'll try to do tomorrow. Big crowd is expected. It's homecoming. It'll be a near sellout if it's not completely sold out. But the big story for Tech is, guys, they're calling it Bully Ball now because that is Terrion Stewart's nickname, Bully, and he ran for 174 yards, kind of a coming-out party down in Raleigh last week, and they're going to give him the ball a whole lot again tomorrow here against Wake Forest. He is a bruising physical running back who reminds a lot of people of Facial Tootin, who played for us the last couple of years and is now at Jacksonville. He breaks tackles. He's hard to bring down. No one wants to get near him defensively. He's just a big, strong dude who's in his first year with Tech. And he hadn't been healthy in the first three or four games, but he played really, really well at NC State last Saturday night.
Well, that may be the answer here, Bill, but what is the key to making sure they beat Wake Forest before traveling to a good Georgia Tech team next week?
Yeah, you know, Wake really should have had Georgia Tech beat last week. Wake's got a new coach. Coach Dicker came from Washington State. He brought a bunch of guys with him. He's got a team that nearly pulled off the upset last week. They're pretty good against the pass, but they've struggled defensively this year against the run. So I would expect Philip Montgomery, the Hokies' interim head coach and offensive coordinator, to try to pound it tomorrow. The offensive line is getting a little bit better as well. So it would be really remarkable if the Hokies could win this thing. They'd be 2-0 in the ACC and back to 3-3 after what was a really opening 21 days with a coach firing and so many opt-outs. It would be pretty cool to see this team get back to 3-3, all things considered.
Bill, educate me on Philip Montgomery a little bit. The initial win over Wofford was kind of a scheduled W, so you make the change, you call the meeting, so to speak, before you play the team you should beat. But the NC State win was impressive to me. And if they come out and handle Wake and win decisively, you know, it's time to start giving the 53-year-old Texan some love here.
You know, he was the head coach at Tulsa for 8 years, but he made his name at Baylor. He was the offensive coordinator at Baylor when RG3 was there. And as you guys know, they put up some ridiculous number. They put up like video game offensive statistics at Baylor, running 110 plays and averaging like 600 yards a game. Well, he was the OC down there, and then he got a head coaching job after that. Did okay at Tulsa. They went to a couple of bowl games, but they decided to make a head coaching change. He was a offensive coordinator in Birmingham in that Pro League, the UFL last year, but he's got a lot of experience. He's been in the SEC. He's been in the Big 12. And our locker room has been really galvanized by his leadership skills. You know, he's got a deep Texas drawl, and he sounds like a Texas football coach, and that's what he is. He's from down there, and our guys have really bonded around him, and they've won two in a row since he's been named head coach.
What would it mean for that kind of a turnaround to end up, as you said, at 3-3, you know, kind of who knows next week at Georgia Tech, but a couple of, you know, make some hay games before the teeth of their schedule down the stretch, three ranked teams right now, Bill, in Florida State, Miami, Virginia. But what would it mean to have that kind of turnaround to be 500 and maybe even have a chance to have a winning record after that start?
Well, it says a lot about the guys on the team. I mean, anybody that can imagine you're 0-3 and your head coach gets fired and a bunch of your players, including some key guys, decide to opt out, transfer, redshirt, and then the guys that stay win three games. I mean, that's pretty cool. I went back and did some research because it's hard to find. The team that I found that started 0-3 all time and then came back at least in college football and did well was in 1983. Penn State started 0-3 and finished 8-4-1. And it can be done. I mean, the odds are not with you to start 0-3 and have a good season, right? Everyone knows that. There's a reason that you're 0-3. But what that Penn State team did, it had great leadership. And I think that's what I did some research and read about that team in 83. I think this team kind of has it. I don't know that we got the roster, candidly, that Joe Paterno had back then. But we got some character guys on our team. So it's interesting. It's a different experience for sure for Tech fans, but they'll be here tomorrow. I think it'll be a really cool homecoming day and a homecoming for the team after last week's road win down at NC State when they take the field here tomorrow.
Bill, have a great call. We will be listening here on the Fan at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And take care of our guy, Toby Altizer. We know he's very high maintenance.
He's such a pain, Bill.
I understand now he's going over to Madrid with the Commanders. Is that unbelievable?
That's what the rumors are saying. I think he's flying on the charter. He's staying in the team hotel. I believe he and Jaden are sharing a room.
So, see, that's the difference. So he's going to Madrid. He's going to get some paella. He's going to dance in the streets. He's going to do that Spanish guitar. And we get to go to Tallahassee. So you see the winner there.
It's the same. It's the same.
Toby won, Bill Roth zero.
Exotic
on that
location.
One, I think. Yeah.
For sure. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Bill. Be good. We'll be listening.
Let's head to the Rude guest hotline. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. We'll say good morning to Mike Loxley, Terps head football coach. He's presented by IT Cadre, trusted insight from trusted insiders. IT Cadre, Coach Lox, how are you this morning?
Fellas, what's going on? How are you guys doing?
We're doing well. Is it hyperbole to say that this upcoming game in College Park with Washington coming into town, first time you've ever faced the Huskies, is one of the more looked forward to games at College Park for the Terps? It seems like there's a real buzz.
There's going to be a lot of people at this game too.
Yeah, we've got a buzz. Our team has generated and created enough buzz in the first third of our season that, you know, as I said earlier to you guys in the year, you know, a lot of people don't know the talent and the team we have, and we didn't really know in terms of how they would perform. And what they've shown the first four games is the consistency that most young, inexperienced teams haven't shown. And what a great opportunity. Again, you know, we joined the Big Ten to play games like this, and for Washington to make the trek across the country and to this area, I mean, what a great atmosphere it'll be. And hopefully we can get the shell completely packed and create a home field advantage for our home team.
They're not making Washington play a real early game because it's a 3:30 game. Not making them play a 10 o'clock game like they did Texas Tech and Utah last week. But you never face Washington. Washington's coming all the way across the country. I tried to watch some of the Ohio State-Washington game last week because I knew you guys were playing them and I wanted to ask you about them. But I was also watching the Ryder Cup too, Coach.
I'm guessing so Coach Loxley's watched the tape.
And
he's seen it.
I know you've seen it. Yeah. And Washington didn't convert a third down until the fourth quarter. Now they're going against the number one team in the country. But what did you notice about Washington, specifically offensively?
I think the big thing is it starts with their quarterback. You know, their quarterback is kind of a Talia Tungavailoa type. kind of scrambles to throw, and if you allow him to break the pocket, he'll really hurt you because he's got, you know, the ability to beat you with his arm and his legs. He's really accurate passer. Not the tall 6'5 guy, but, you know, he's shown that he's tall enough to make the throws he needs to make. And then, you know, you pair that with the rushing attack. I think they've got one of the top leading rushers in our league, and you know, he's a heavy-handed runner that, you know, we got to do a great job for us on the defensive side of getting a lot of hats to the ball and doing a great job of being physical and finishing on our tackles.
So, Coach, a lot has been made about your record after the bye week. You talked about it earlier this week, and you said that you kind of grew up with the Nick Saban approach. Tell us what that was and what changed this year about your approach during the bye.
Yeah, you know, for us, it was almost like a mini spring ball or a mini camp like the NFL has. And what you typically want to do is develop your younger players and get your veteran guys healthy during the bye week. And so in the past, we've been really physical. We've kept the same amount of time that we've been on the field like we do all week. But, you know, we're at a point right now depth-wise where we're about 17 players less than what we've carried over the years. And we had to be smart, so we shortened some of the practices. Still was able to get 2 days of really physical practices, but we went back to kind of the basics. You know, as you go and look at what we've done in self-scout the first third of our year, on offense, we hadn't been great on third down, but we've protected the football, so we put a big emphasis on the third down situations a week ago. And, you know, we got some guys back healthy. I equate the bye week a little bit like a prize fight where, you know, in between rounds, the boxer sits on the stool, but his eyes remain on his opponent across the ring. But he gets recovered. He gets some coaching and some instruction. And he's able to, you know, get himself healthy to go finish the fight. And that's kind of where we are.
Coach, I was also reading that your players said they got like a prescription card from you guys with what they needed to work on. Who came up with that idea? And did every player on the roster get one of these prescription cards?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer in studying, and now that I'm kind of back in tune with these guys, you can't fix everything at one time. And so what I've tried to do and what I've instructed our coaches to do during the bye week was to give every player one part of their game that they need to improve upon. And, you know, what happens when you develop your skill, you know, your talent kind of gets you into the door. Our talent has gotten people to be intrigued about us, but to keep them there, we got to play with skill. And so we really tried to focus on the fundamentals, running, blocking, tackling, catching, throwing, and making sure that whatever deficiency that we see that could elevate our team individually, we give each player that thing to fix. And we called it a prescription. We geared our individual periods towards fixing some of these fundamental issues that show up. And I'm a big believer that as we get better individually, we'll get better collectively. And I thought we did that a week ago.
Are you surprised at the maturity of Malik Washington through the four games, or is this just something that you expect from him? You knew he had this sort of mind frame and, you know, mindset heading into games. Even is he 18 or 19? How old is he at this point?
Yeah, I mean, he's still 18.
And, 18 years and old.
I've kind of known that it, I mean, I've spent a lot of time with this kid over the last 4 years of recruiting him and getting to know him and his mental makeup and how he's been built. And there's no doubt that the maturity has always been there, but I couldn't tell you that until we see him live in bullets, which we've seen him in the first four games and how he's responded. And even when he hasn't played great within the game at times, nothing seems to rattle him. He seems to have kind of that gumption and moxie that you want to see out of that position.
I can't remember which game it was. It might have been the Wisconsin game where during the broadcast they showed pictures of Malik as like, I think he was like a 7 or 8 year old kid, maybe a little bit older, but they showed him in his bedroom lying on his bed with the Ravens bed covers, and he was he was studying plays.
Playbooks.
He was like studying plays as an 8 or 9 year old, like how to run the
offense. He was destined to do it.
That's the sort of level of dedication that you're getting with this kid.
Yeah, and we've, you know, with this class that he helped bring in, guys like Sid Stewart and Zaire Mathis and C.J. Smith, you know, they all have come in with this maturity. And, you know, it goes, again, kudos to the local high school coaches that have done a tremendous job of elevating, you know, high school football, youth football in this area. And, you know, to see these guys be able to come in and initially perform the way they have. Now, we've still got 2/3 of a season to go. We're in the Big Ten schedule, great opponent in Washington showing up. Another great opportunity to measure and just see exactly who we are. If we want to really be in the mix with the Big Ten, and Washington's one of those teams that people have a lot of respect for. So it's a great opportunity for us and to get to know what kind of team we have.
What's the key to this game, in your opinion?
Whoever plays with the best fundamentals, you know, Washington matches up really well with us. They've got speed on the outside at receiver and corner like we do. Mm-hmm. They've got some length on the O-line and D-line. Their front seven on defense is a really stout group. It's going to come down to containing that quarterback and limiting those explosives that he has the ability to create. But for us on offense, finding a way to generate more explosives, and we're going to need a few more plays on offense, which means we got to be good on third down.
You were talking about that running back, Jonah Coleman, I think is his name. Yep. He's five. I don't know. This is what he's listed at 5'9", 230. I mean, he's a freaking tank. He's a bowling ball. And he's also pretty good out of the backfield too, because they like to throw to him.
He is. He's a multidimensional runner that has some receiving skills. You know, with those low center gravity runners, that's where what I talked about. We better put the big boy pads on and have a bunch of guys at the party when we arrive, because he is a finishing heavy-handed runner. Now, we've shown the ability and the propensity to be physical as well, and so it'll be a great matchup.
Yeah. You know, just kind of growing up a Maryland fan, because I grew up in PG County, and I grew up 5 miles from the campus, but it was always obviously ACC games. And the fact that you guys are hosting Washington and then hosting Nebraska in back-to-back weeks, I mean, it's just crazy how much college sports has changed, especially with the Big Ten.
Yeah, and that's, again, you know, when you start talking about conferences and, you know, when you think of these two matchups in back-to-back weeks, these are blue blood programs over the years that have had a lot of success and great reputations. And to be able to bring them to the confines of the Shell here in College Park is great for the area. The exposure, you know, anytime you create diversity at the table, it adds value, and these both those programs, much like us, have added a tremendous amount of value to the Big Ten. And I know I'm excited about being a part of this league and having the opportunity to play games like this and play them here in the area that I grew up in and grew up loving.
You know, we kind of opened up talking about the buzz building. You talked about the buzz building. How important is it to you as a coach to have the fans represent, sell out? And I'm wondering, during your time here, your tenure at Maryland, is there a game that stands out that you believe was the best crowd? Because there have been some that have been underwhelming.
Yeah, I've been around here 17 seasons now, so I've seen a few football games, and whether it's Bird Stadium, CQ, Capital One, whatever it is. My favorite at home in the Shell was in 2001. We played Clemson in a night game, and Florida State had just lost to NC State, and I can remember Coach Friesen saying we at least have tied for the ACC championship, you know, because of that loss, and all we had to do was go win. And when I got up to the press box and looked across and saw the big second deck that we have over there, to see every corner of it packed was like, man, okay, this is what it's all about. And so I would say the Clemson 2001 home game was one that kind of stands out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Coach Locks, how lucky do you feel to have Pep Hamilton in the mix on your coaching staff as the offensive coordinator? I mean, this is a guy who's a football lifer. You know, he started his coaching career at his alma mater at Howard in 1997. He's been on several NFL staffs. He's been an offensive coordinator in the NFL. I mean, that's a coup for you to land him to help run that, basically run the Terps offense.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And most people that know me know Pep has been one of my closest friends in coaching. You know, he actually did an analyst position here in 2001 when they got let go at Howard, and I got Coach Friesen to allow him to be kind of a volunteer coach here with us that year. And, you know, Pep and I, over the years, we've seen our kids grow up, and what that's helped me do is get back into that locker room, because, you know, when you've coached the quarterbacks and you're calling plays and you're game planning and scripting, as I said before, it's hard to see the forest through the trees. And what Pep has been able to do in terms of organizing the Maryland offensive system that we've run allows me to get back to doing some of the other things that I need to do to push the right buttons and get these guys to play at a high level.
Coach, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but I read this yesterday, and I'm taking it right here from ESPN.com, but the Big Ten is in discussions about a private capital deal that would infuse $2 billion into the conference. I'm not sure what the company is that's going to give the money. Essentially, you guys will all be equal equity partners with the Big Ten and with this company and with all the teams. That's a lot of money if it happens. I guess there's going to be a decision next week. How much of this do you know about, and can you talk about it, and did you know that there were discussions?
I mean, everybody that's followed the landscape the last 2 to 3 years has known that private equity is coming.
Mm-hmm.
We've all kind of done research. I know private equity at one point approached Maryland because, you know, during that three-year run, we were winning based on the resources at a higher rate, which makes you attractive. And the Big Ten's an attractive league. We've kind of always led the charge along with the SEC. That's way over my pay grade in terms of how and what it affects. All I've ever talked about is just get us enough resources to put us in the middle of the Big Ten, and I think you'll see us consistently perform and compete to be in the mix. So I know the best thing that's happened lately around here is bringing in a guy like Jim Smith, who understands the business of sport. He's been at the professional leagues, and not just with the Falcons. He's been with the Braves. He's been with the soccer team. He's done a bunch of different business of sport deals. And I would imagine that, you know, with his expertise on that, he's going to continue to try to put Maryland in the best possible position to get this thing where we all want it to be and where it should be.
Yeah, well, if you're going to chop $2 billion, that's going to help a lot.
It certainly won't hurt.
I hope so.
You know, all right.
Well, Coach Locks, we're pulling for you, obviously, this weekend against Washington. Get that dub, and hopefully the Shell is packed. I think I saw a day or two ago only 2,500 tickets were left. I'm sure it's less than that by now. So hopefully it's a full-blown sellout.
That's a big one.
This Saturday when
big
the Huskies
Network.
Come to town. Thanks, Coach Locks.
No doubt. Appreciate you guys. Thanks for having me.
Right, of course, that's Mike Locksley, Terps head football coach, presented by IT Cadre. Trusted insight from trusted insiders, IT Cadre.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.